Welcome to NJASA's Frontline Leadership for Extraordinary Times video podcast series. Today we will be speaking with the Wildwood School District Superintendent, Jay Kenyon Cummings. Kenyon, thanks for joining us. This is our sixth broadcast. And before we begin, how are you and your family doing?
Thanks for having me. We're doing well. We're adhering to all the distancing protocols that we can. I'm in Wildwood a few times a week as needed. We're kind of spreading ourselves out across the schedule to cover the building. As far as at home goes, we're healthy. I have three boys, 6, 10, and 12, so I'm doing a lot of home repair. So we're making some lessons out of that. They're learning how to sheetrock. They've learned how to put doorknobs back on. We had one urgent care visit for stitches, but not COVID-related. But it's I'm sure my problems aren't unique, but we're making the best of it and trying to enjoy the extra family time we have.
Well, I'm sure they'll remember that, and I bet you that's even added reason that they want to be right back in school as quickly as they can. So, hey, as you know, we've been speaking with chief education officers from a variety of diverse school districts throughout the state. While the conversations have been unique to their districts, there has been good information that we've been able to share universally with all of our members. In your case, Wildwood High School serves roughly 240 students. 66% of your student population are minority, with the majority being Hispanic. So tell us some of the challenges facing your district. You might want to address technology, online learning, and parental engagement in your response.
So Wildwood High is one of the smallest high schools in the state of New Jersey. District-wide, we're about 950 students. We actually diversify at the high school from our sending districts coming in. So we have more affluent students coming in from our sending districts. So we actually, our poverty percentages and our minority percentages go down. If you look at our pre-K to 8 population, we're 80% minority. We are a CEP district, so we qualify for the community eligibility provision for food assistance. There have been years where we've hit a 90% free and reduced lunch rate for our K to 8 population. So that's a proxy for poverty. We've come up in the SAPE, in the census data. Wildwood has been either 1 or 2 as far as a city goes for having the highest percentage of students living below the poverty line in New Jersey. So the digital divide is a very real thing for us. We knew we were not future ready going into this. We are limited on resources. We're one of the districts losing aid as a result of S2. The Chromebooks we have came through donation money. We're lucky that we have a long history and we have a lot of third-party partners and alumni that have donated money along the years. But the devices we have were purchased through those revenue streams. So initially when the closure happened, as everybody knows, we planned for 2 to 3 weeks of instruction. And the directive to our teaching faculty was to make it assignments that do not need technology to be completed so that we're not excluding anybody. As we got deeper into the closure, teachers began trying using some of the software that we have. We've been a Google school for a long time, a Google district for a long time. And it appeared that there was really a need to try to do some kind of a deployment. So we began doing that actually during spring break. We took the time. We had to invest in new firewall technology. We didn't have cases for the Chromebooks that we had. We needed to come up with a sign-out procedure. We leaned on some of our colleagues to get updates to policy, some guidance in terms of authorized user policies, what types of filtering they do, what kind of protocols are in place for that. So we began distributing those Chromebooks. Now what we're finding, now that they're out and teachers are utilizing them, is that there's a connectivity issue, which we knew of already, and we've been sharing information about subsidized internet. All the hotspots are open in the city of Wildwood, but if you're not in close proximity to those hotspots, they don't always work. And also some of the subsidized internet programs, you're not eligible for them if you have an outstanding balance, and that's a reality that a lot of our families live with. So we are grappling with that now. So it's more and more the deeper we get into it, we learn about just the inequities with access to technology and how students who come from poverty and don't have a lot of resources, how they're negatively affected by that. I'll share another thing that came up along the way. Like, we did get filtering software that allowed us to monitor the internet activity of our students, but some of the flags that come through that software are creating new tasks that we didn't anticipate. Some of the searches, for example, like what to do if you're in an abusive relationship and things of that nature. So I'm happy that we have a mechanism that is catching some of those things, because those are things we usually deal within the building with our guidance counselors, and we have close relationships with our students, as well as other staff members. But now we're creating a protocol for that and making sure that that information gets to principals, who can then dispatch the appropriate counselors and contact parents and guardians and families. So those are, like I said, our problems probably are not unique district to district, but we're learning this as we begin to implement this new medium for instruction.
Quite a significant challenge, you know, and I hear the same thing, whether it's in a large city or a smaller community such as yours, where there's poverty and the ability to stay in touch with kids and families in order to connect them. How are your teachers adapting to this technology as well in outreach?
Our teachers have been phenomenal. They, like, right from the get-go, some districts were either modifying their schedule, doing a partial day or doing a day off to prepare for this. We've said this before, but if we close school, that means breakfast and lunch is not accessed by 950 students. So that's the reality we live in. And it's great that we have such a great team of faculty that understand that. So they were very flexible in preparing the materials as we got ready. And then along the way, there's been an open dialogue with our teachers, and teachers are comfortable emailing or contacting any of us with good ideas. Like, a lot of our ideas I can only give credit for. I can't take credit for them. They're coming from our staff, our faculty, our parents, board members. So they've been great along this way. So a lot of our work has been kind of flipped in, like, how can we best support them and make sure that we're assessing their needs and we have a medium that they can get that to us.
You know, I've observed frequently in these conversations that times of difficulty, the school becomes really a focus, a center, a stabilizing force, if you will, in reaching out to communities. You talked about the issue of feeding students, and as you say, all of the school district population. I noted that you had a wonderful farm-to-table program that complemented your student food programs. Is it possible to maintain that now? What are some of the issues that you have in reaching out and connecting with the families and the food distribution?
So we have a couple CTE programs, and one of them is the culinary program, and we had just finished completing our greenhouse in our courtyard at the beginning of this school year. So we already had an outdoor community garden that our Wave 21 21st Century program maintained. A lot of that overage, we use that for programs and celebrations during school. It went into the culinary program, and we would also gift it to families or assist, like, local restaurants with any overage that we had. So we do have faculty that have volunteered to come in and seed those gardens and make sure that they're maintained. And then the greenhouse was really a partnership with a lot of different entities, and one of the alumni actually runs a farm and a greenhouse type business. So Lenny Catanosa has been assisting us and helping us get everything ready so that we can start utilizing the greenhouse for that, with the expectation that we'll slowly be returning to normal, hopefully by next school year.
Yeah, I agree. That's a lot of discussion right now. You know, will we return before the end of the school year? And I think most of us assume that that's really just not going to be possible with the information that we're receiving. Mm-hmm. You talked about this, the food program, the culinary program, as part of career and technical education. What other kinds of programs are your students involved in, and what percentage of your population, roughly, do you think are involved in those kind of programs?
So it's a small high school, but there's a lot of unique opportunities there. It's a resort town. So we first implemented the culinary program just because it made a lot of sense as far as opportunities locally went for our students, to give them those skills. Either it's going to cover your employment for a summer or while you're navigating college, or it could be an actual career for students. So there's a nice spectrum of opportunity there. So we have the culinary program in place. We're developing a Tomorrow's Teachers program. We put a preschool classroom in our high school this year because we needed a spot to expand the program. And also we created a laboratory setting for our high school students to participate in. We got approval for our law enforcement program this year, and we're also just in the final stages of finishing our industrial tech program, which is kind of like, it's a wood shop type class, but it covers property maintenance, framing, sheetrock, painting, electrical, plumbing. There's some CAD concepts in there. We have a CNC machine. It's kind of like a full design and build type setting. So that's our most traditional type program that we have right now. Those programs, that some of them are just academic, like the law enforcement and the teaching concepts, but culinary and the industrial arts, those are the types of programs that are they're engaging because they're very hands-on. So students tend to enjoy them. So a credit to our faculty, our chef, and also the teacher of the industrial arts program or the industrial tech program. They're doing Zoom type lessons through Google Meets to the best of their ability. But obviously those are very resource dependent programs. Students don't have the materials to build in their homes. There's probably limited cooking opportunity as far as some of the concepts that the chef is teaching, but they're doing their best to assess what the students have at home so they can participate. But those are programs that are just heavily reliant on the resources within the physical plant. So we're just, as we, with everything else, we're just doing our best to keep those programs going.
Quite a breadth of programs for the kids. And I know one of the things that we've spoken about in the past, and you talk about a large percentage of your school population being Hispanic, is developing the teachers. And you've started this teaching practice program, I'm sure, as well, with the hope of having some of those minority students eventually come back to your town to teach in your schools to help bolster those children that are in your community.
That's true. So we had done a lot of research. We're very isolated in the bottom of the state. So you do want to make sure that you have a balanced approach to your hiring practices as far as the demographics go. So you kept hearing a lot of things about the minority pipeline to education and things of that nature. And the deeper that we dug into that, you see the same patterns that you see with standardized assessments, the portfolio assessments, the SAT, the ACT, as far as how different demographic groups score in those areas. So you kind of control what you can control. So we're trying to inspire, like, this is one of our own local approaches to that. Like, we've gone on the record and we've testified about our concerns with the way that we prepare teachers and how there's a lot of obstacles there and the data to show what those outcomes are creating. But locally, we like to put our money where our mouth is. So we developed the Tomorrow's Teachers program in the hopes that we would instill some passions for the field of education for our students. And our higher ed partner for that looks like it's going to be Stockton. So we've been working with Dean Keenan a lot to see what types of courses we could hold in Wildwood to develop a true CTE program for that, but also create a pipeline direct into Stockton, which is our closest four-year institution, which our students tend to do pretty well with. They're only about 40 minutes away from home when they go to that campus if there's anything that they need to rely on from back home in Wildwood.
That's a fantastic initiative. Thanks for taking some time to talk about that. Now, as we get into, if you will, in the typical school year, we're celebrating a lot in the month of, late April, May, and June. And as we get closer to what might be the end of this current school year, more and more conversation with kids in media reports with regard to, gee, what about all the things we used to do, and particularly, how are we going to celebrate graduations? What's the conversation in your community?
So some of the more immediate events, prom obviously is postponed until further notice. That was going to be on May 16th, which would be the day after the governor said he'd address the reopening again. As far as graduation goes, we're planning for different tiers of interaction. So obviously, depending on what we're allowed to do at that time, our graduation date is June 16th. So if we're allowed to be together, the plan will be to be together as usual. We also have some different ideas that we've sketched up to just do a completely virtual graduation, which, you know, I feel the most for our seniors because there's so many great events to kind of cap their time at Wildwood High School. And these are events that have been going on for over 100 years. So it's sad that part of their experience is being interrupted. But So I'll get back to the different tiers. So we also looked at what we could do with the boardwalk. Could we do something where we spaced out people responsibly, depending on what the restrictions are, and did something on that type of structure. I know that we've looked at doing drive-through graduations and even looking at our football field and just really spacing people out responsibly on the football field. So both locally and as a county, we've been looking at these things. Like, we do a lot of really good collaboration and communication, which has even improved, which I didn't think that was possible, but it's gotten even better during the pandemic as far as sharing information and leaning on each other to try to navigate these issues and come up with good solutions and solutions that can work for all of us, so that we're taking a common position on behalf of the students and the faculty and the safety of the general public.
Yeah, it's a real conversation and hard to make a decision. We don't know what to expect in 4 to 6 weeks with regard to what restrictions will still remain in place and what can happen. So I'm certainly very impressed with the conversations in each of the counties, with people talking to one another, sharing their good ideas. And as we get together in conversations such as this one and our state committees that are meeting virtually, we kind of share that among the 21 counties as to what are some solutions that might work in your district. So, Kenan, thank you for being with us today. Are any last thoughts that you'd like to share?
Just to piggyback on that, I think that we've gotten a lot of great support from our local Board of Education. We have a lot of parents and even grandparents on that board. So they serve as a good access point for information about what the experience of their children, their grandchildren are, and as far as giving us the flexibility to figure this out as we take on something that I don't think any of us ever anticipated we'd have to navigate. The guidance that we've gotten from the DOE and our commissioner, I think that's been really helpful. The support of our colleagues within the NJASA has been huge for me, just to lean on people and get information. I'm really happy that we've made some important monumental decisions on behalf of what's good for kids and people. I think the relaxation of the evaluation protocols for teachers and the relaxation of the graduation requirements for high school students, I think, was really very appreciated in the right direction for what we need to do. I think graduation, how to graduate from high school, has been a moving target for too long. So maybe there's some lessons learned from this as we assess how that decision's gone, because there's going to be even, I think, some summer slide, summer loss type academic outcomes from this, just from not having our students for so long, which will bleed into next year. So I'm hoping that we can continue to kind of give the responsibility of issuing diplomas to students to the districts and not have it be such a complex process. But I know that we're focused on keeping people safe now, but I'm hoping that we return to that.
Yeah, a lot of discussion right now and with regard to what might happen in the summertime, what might happen in September. So this collaboration and working with the leadership of the department is really critical. Kenan, thank you very much for being with me. Good luck as you progress through the rest of the school year.
Thank you.
To our viewers today and our listeners, remember, we will be distributing one video podcast interview per week. So please monitor your email, visit njasa.net, and subscribe to our NJASA podcast. Until next time, I'm Rich Baza. Please stay safe and healthy.